Hello, welcome to Jay Talks Live. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, host of this webcast series, and I'm also the host of the CBC podcast, More. Today, we're talking about Canadian leadership at the provincial and federal levels and the response to COVID-19, the biggest health and economic challenge of our time. And joining me today is Chantal Hébert, a regular political contributor to a number of news organizations, including the Toronto Star, L'Actualité, and the Ad Issue panel for CBC News's The National. But first, the Canadian Journalism Foundation wants to thank the generosity of Jay Talks series sponsor, BMO Financial Group, for making this speaker series possible. And also the CJF would like to thank the in-kind support of Cision and CPAC. A few helpful notes for this webcast if you're joining us for the first time. If your internet quality is poor, click on the click here to switch stream to view at a lower bandwidth. The quality of the video will decrease, but the audio should remain the same. If you are having technical issues, click on the request help button at the bottom right corner of the webcast page, and your request will be emailed back to the email address you provided. The answer will be returned. This webcast is 40 minutes long. I'm going to chat with Chantal first before taking your questions. You can submit your questions anytime using the questions tab. And if you want to tweet about this talk, you can use the hashtag JTalksLive. So now on to our guest, Chantal Hébert. Welcome.
Thank you.
You have seen so many leaders navigating so many crises. What are you seeing in terms of leadership now during this crisis that has surprised you?
I have seen leaders negotiate crises over the years. None that was on this scale in any way, shape, or form. At no time in any of those crises was there the level of political consensus crossing party lines between first ministers to the level that we've been seeing. Usually, in a crisis, there are differences in approaches. Everybody wants to do whatever is best, but you can see some sharp political divide emerge. At this juncture, after we're 2.5 months in, what may be the longest period of federal-provincial harmony in the history of the Federation.
And you see that starting to weaken now?
Not yet. What I thought has been a strand of this crisis and the way it has been managed is that no one has given up ground to someone else. I.e., the federal government has been very proactive on a number of fronts that are totally within its area of jurisdiction, but at the same time, more respectful of what the provinces do and where their sovereignty is politically, education, healthcare, than possibly previous liberal government. And that probably has a lot to do with the fact that while the prime minister and the premiers have been of one mind on many issues, the premiers, most of them not liberal, and none of them liberal in the larger provinces, are also very mindful of what their knitting is and what the federal government is. It could have been a big weakness. We've seen federal provincial showdowns. I think, for one, it's unrealistic to expect in a crisis like this one, which has very practical implications, to expect a one-size-fits-all kind of leadership coming from the top down and saying, well, we are going to treat Prince Edward Island and its situation in the same way that we approach what is going on in Ontario. But also, you know, there's a lot of trial and error taking place at this juncture. And it's not necessarily a bad thing that while they're all in the same framework, some provinces are trying things out, others are not. François Legault in Quebec was the first to throw himself in the very cold swimming pool of reopening schools, and then he did not. But he was the first to test the waters. I think that educated other premiers as to what to do and what not to do to manage those touchy issues. The same goes for other provinces. I think BC, in many ways, has emerged as kind of a template for doing things right. And so provinces have been learning from each other at the same time as they've been coordinating with the federal government. I think that's been a constructive approach. And no, for now, I don't see huge cracks. I think because there is a common will to make sure not to have those cracks, and they do exist, become huge gaps between provinces or between the federal government and the provinces.
It's interesting what you say about BC too, because in BC, it seems to me more than in any other jurisdiction, we've seen the premier cede to Dr. Bonnie Henry. Like, she is the main voice, not the premier every day in briefings.
And I think there's a lesson there that maybe has been learned a bit late in the game by premiers such as François Legault. The Quebec premier early on was scoring incredible approval rating scores that we've not seen on this side of a democracy or the Canadian democracy or Quebec in our lifetimes. But over time, and as the harder part, which means the timing of what you reopen, how you go about it, how risky it is, the perception set in that maybe the health authorities were being politicized or that they were being made to validate what politicians wanted rather than politicians taking their lead from health officers. So I think the BC approach on that has been fairly solid. On the other hand, I do think that most Canadians do want to see their premiers on the front line and the prime minister on the front line. And if you look at the polls, you know, how many, by now, Justin Trudeau will probably have given more news conferences than any premier prime minister that we've ever covered, to the point where I don't think we'll be signing petitions in the press gallery to have more press conferences for a while. And it seems to work. I mean, it works politically, but it also seems to have generated an uncommonly high amount of public approval for the measures that he has put in place.
Talk to me a little bit more about what you're seeing in the approval polls.
I'm not the polling expert, but I think over time you look at numbers like that and you say there's a lot of fool's gold in there. It's nobody is going to who is in office in an adversarial system like our system is going to enjoy an approval rating of 75%, 80% forever. And that doesn't really mean partisan approval or shouldn't translate into that. I go back to the closest case, which would be the ice storm in 1998 in Quebec, and Premier Lucien Bouchard kind of pioneered this approach of having premier next to expert on a daily basis saying, this things are going to be okay, this is what we're doing today, this is the answer to that, and to have the expert answer. Lucien Bouchard at that point, so we're in January 1988, is riding really high on the polls. The approval ratings he gets for the managing the ice storm is huge. And think of it, you know, Hydro-Quebec is an icon in this province. The notion that it's failing in the way that it failed so graphically at the time should be a big blow. But then fast forward, 8-9 months later, provincial election, new Liberal leader, Jean Charest, and Lucien Bouchard does win re-election in a majority mandate, but he loses the popular vote. In clear, that those approval ratings, once you put them to the test in the ballot box, they will, some of them will endure. And if you fail miserably, you will lose. But if you're standing at 75%, the opposition looks like it's dead in the water. I think that in Ontario and Quebec, for instance, there won't be a provincial election if the premiers stick to the fixed date elections in those provinces for at least another, about 2 years, maybe three. Well, at that point, we are going to be somewhere else, which may be economically a very difficult period. And over that time, for sure, more debate and less consensus will have emerged.
Let's talk a little bit more about the opposition, because the federal conservatives, of course, are prepping for leadership contest. They're in the middle of a leadership contest. What are you thinking as you watch Andrew Scheer and as you watch that leadership contest go forward?
I think hindsight is 2020, especially in this case. In hindsight, the Conservatives would have been better served by appointing a different interim leader than Andrew Scheer. That they expected that all they would have to do would be to handle question period for a few months, and then they would have a new leader in June. That is not what has happened, and Andrew Scheer's handling of the party over the course of this pandemic has been tone deaf, and it has cost the Conservatives a lot of ground that his successor will have to try to catch up to. I would say that he is messed up his exit from the front line over the past few months, and I have a point of comparison. For some reason, the Conservatives, this is the second time that a Conservative Party in official opposition is faced with a landmark crisis at the time when it is picking a new leader. And the last time was 9/11, when Stockwell Day was campaigning for his own job and was the leader of the opposition as leader of the Canadian Alliance. And if you compare the performance of the Canadian Alliance in the months that followed 9/11 against the backdrop of that leadership campaign where Mr. Day himself was a candidate, to the performance of Andrew Scheer over those same months, you would find that the official opposition was really more competent and did not look like a party that was leaderless and headless in the way that the Conservatives have looked over the past 2-3 months. Whether they can catch up once they have a new leader is for whoever wins to figure out, but it will be a bigger rebuild than might have been the case if the past 3 months had been spent in other ways. I mean, the Conservative Party federally is the big loser federally of the past 3 months. The NDP has lost a few points here and there, but is mostly stable. The Bloc Québécois has held solid, and both of those have not gone aggressively after Justin Trudeau and seem to have captured the public mood. When you see advertising from a federal party, the official opposition, that says Justin Trudeau has failed you, and there is 80% approval rating for every single measure or almost every single federal measure, you think, on what planet can you think that you will have an audience when you start off with a perception that has absolutely nothing to do with how the audience you're trying to expand is thinking?
And what do you, like, in terms of the actual contestants for this, what are you watching? What's really striking you as you see what they're up to?
Well, they are in a difficult position in the sense that this has not been a context that has allowed people who are running for the leadership of the Conservative Party to really go out and recruit a lot of new members. That's really hard to do when you're sitting at home and you can't go out and meet and greet people and put some personal touch in what you're doing. So they're basically campaigning for the grassroots solid base of the party. That base, every single poll shows that base does not really reflect the mainstream voters you need to win an election. So if you're running to be Andrew Scheer's successor, you may need to get you over the top to win over the religious right and the social conservatives in the party. But they are immensely more important inside that membership than they are in the general population. Moreover, the more influence you tend to go to give those issues, abortion, same-sex marriage, the less appealing you become to the voters you would need to win an election. So on the morning after that leadership, I think at this point, most observers have kind of given up on seeing real debate over what happens next. Once we're past the pandemic, But I'm guessing the test of that new leader is going to be to come up with something that looks like something other than a critique of what Justin Trudeau may or may not have done over the past 4, 5, 6 months by the time he or she is chosen.
You touched on a couple of minutes ago the issue of the economy, and we may be in a different place in 2 or 3 years. But if you look at where we are right now, are you in the camp that thinks Justin Trudeau will or should do an election quicker than planned?
Will and should are two different things in this case. I am convinced that once we've turned the corner on the pandemic, and that's not tomorrow, and that certainly is not till in 2020. But suppose that this time next year, we have been fortunate enough to have this pretty much under control, then the point will certainly be made by smart liberal strategists to the prime minister that this is a good time to ask for a new mandate before he has to do something about the fiscal situation of the federal government, which eventually would translate into things that most taxpayers will probably not like. So the rationale would be go while you're still in the stimulus period, in the good news period, rather than in the pain, inflicting pain period. I'm not sure that I agree with that, but that's based also on my sense of what third mandates have been in this country. And I take you back, you were there, to Jean Chrétien's third mandate. Remember that? Third majority win, followed by a civil war within the Liberal Party, and the entire third mandate was consumed by leadership politics, and a clock ticking on Jean Chrétien's leadership, had it not been for 9/11, which forced the government of the day to take action, Mr. Chrétien's legacy would not have been the legacy that he had because of his decisions on the Iraq war, etc. Stephen Harper's third mandate was, you know, finally a conservative majority, the first in this country in decades, and ended up being less than his minority mandates. Again, with forever questions as to will he run, will he not run, should he not go? And in both cases, Jean Chrétien and Stephen Harper, scandals over patronage in one case and the Senate, over the sponsorship program in the other. So me, I think that Justin Trudeau calls an election on the morning after he is reelected, if he is reelected, especially to a majority, people inside the Liberal Party start thinking about his successor.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the long tail on this. Like the economy, we're going to see a lot of changes, obviously. And I'm wondering what big policy changes you are thinking about that may come out of this, and what kind of fight that might also generate.
You know, we talked about the creative tension between the non-liberal premiers and the prime minister. I don't for a second believe that François Legault or Doug Ford or Jason Kenney have converted to the notion of a big, strong central government over the course of this crisis. And if anything, they are not going to be buying into a host of new federal-led programs unless there's a lot of money that the federal government no longer has on the table. So, strangely enough, I've come to think that maybe we'll see progress on childcare and cooperation on childcare. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, but there is a new door opening for federal politicians and pro-public childcare advocates as a result of this crisis, and that's the economy. Unless you get proper childcare in place, it's going to be very hard to get the economy back to where it was, because parents without childcare need to work. So there could be space there. I'm sure that there will be discussions about, basic income, replacing the current social safety net by something other. I believe that there will be a lot of pushback from the provinces as they're currently configured politically against any initiative that would end up giving more social policy leadership to the federal government. I don't believe there's been a sea change in attitudes on that. And speaking from this province, you know, I saw the, I think it was Abacus poll this morning that asked, or Ligi, one or the other, who do you think has the lead or should have the lead on reopening the economy and reopening, going back to normal life? And the numbers were, you know, 60% believed it should be the provinces. It's a 2-to-1 to the federal government. But when you looked at the breakdown provincially, little has changed. What drives these numbers are provinces like Quebec and Alberta, where the overwhelming majority is saying the lead is with the provinces, which is totally traditional response from those provinces. You look at the numbers for Ontario, and it's split almost 50-50. And Ontario has always been more split over the notion that, yes, a strong central federal government is a good thing, in part because many Ontarians see themselves as Canada. It helps. But so I don't think federal provincial attitudes or voters' outlooks on who does what have changed dramatically, even as they approve of Justin Trudeau's strategies. They have, I don't think, are suddenly thinking we need the federal government to, you know, be the senior government in this country.
And of course, that's a double-edged sword for the provinces, because they are not only responsible for those jurisdictions that we can all reach out and touch, they are also will get the credit or the blame.
And there will likely be more blame than credit going forward when you discover, you know, your former childcare space doesn't exist anymore because of social distancing. Classrooms, how will that work in places like Toronto and Montreal, where a spare space for classrooms with 15 students instead of 30 work out? What has happened in long-term care homes is something that goes right to the laps of the premiers. I'm guessing that both François Legault and Premier Ford are kind of happy to be leading new governments that have not been in power over the past decade, so that they can share some of this blame, certainly for not seeing this coming in the immediate crisis, but for the systemic problems that have been brought to the fore. The blame is shared with opposition parties, once again making the job of being an opposition party difficult.
Do you think the public might want to demand a federal oversight on something like elder care, given what's happened in long-term care in provinces across this country?
I'd be amazed, at least looking at it from the perspective of the province that has had the most deaths. I see a lot of public questions, popular discomfort, unease, anger over what has happened. But that, as far as I can tell, is not translating into the notion that the federal government should suddenly take a bigger role in running the health system, which, by the way, it does not really have the expertise to do.
Just talking about policy, there are those who are really pushing for some kind of integrated climate change environmental policy to come out of this as well. What's your read on that? What are you seeing?
I think I understand the notion of using every crisis as an opportunity, but it would probably, over the longer term, be a mistake to try to tie climate change and the fight against climate change to restoring the economy. I think if one mood is underestimated, and I believe by the media, along with all of the groups that see opportunities for change in what has happened, it's the fact that out here on the ground, people want their old lives back. They don't think the past was bad and here's a chance to change it. The first thing they want is, again, some normal life. And that I think the underestimating the appetite for a return to normal, the old normal, the boring bad that we should change, is probably going to make some groups cast their lot on unsustainable premises. We're bringing you change. I think people have had it with change at this point. It's not that that there will not be public interest in climate change, but when you have a mortgage that you're not sure how to pay, a job that you don't know how to return to because your kids can't go to school, and not knowing where that or how that second wave will or will not come, and looking at a 2 years horizon, you don't have a lot of patience for high-minded talk about, oh, well, this is a great opportunity to change our lives. I think most Canadians feel that we've changed our lives enough at this point.
If anything, there may be real fallout for the idea that the second wave, which we have been reminded and warned is coming, which will mean likely shutdowns and more closing, the reaction of how each leader handles that will be under even greater scrutiny, will it not?
Up to a point. The thing is that to forecast 3 months down the road is to look through fog and pretend to see a landscape. I'm guessing the hope is that, you know, better testing, possibly better ways to mitigate this virus, eventually a vaccine, will intervene between the first and the second wave. There's too much that experts don't know to forecast with any certainty, but for sure, people are dreading what happens next fall. And there is a general understanding that you can only stop life for so long. And if you're thinking of spending next winter confined, everyone knows that at some point the cure will become worse than the illness. So I'm guessing a lot of government leaders have their fingers crossed that over this reopening phase, people are learning to live with COVID-19 rather than totally avoiding it.
Let's go to some of the questions. I've got a long list of questions. I won't get through them all, but I'm going to start with one from Richard Rin, who's asking, what are you doing during self-isolation?
Well, I'm doing much, I have a huge advantage over most people. I've been working from home for 15 years, so I'm used to being alone. And yes, I'm getting dressed in the morning to pretend that that means my workday is starting. And when I have spare moments, because I do have them, I can't, you know, go shopping for food all that much during the day. It's not all that pleasant anymore. I do virtual babysitting for my grandchildren, hoping to help their parents remain sane.
How many grandchildren?
I have 5, 2, and 3. So, in 2 places. But so I've become really good at Zooming with things like books to read and stuff.
That's terrific.
It's kind of fun. I'm sure that when this is over, maybe I'll miss it more than they will.
I'll give you a couple more questions here. This comes from Catherine Sesto. Should the government and media withhold speculative information from the public as to avoid fear-mongering?
How would they know that it's speculative? So now I'll tell you a story for, you know, the school of certainty, and we all know what is what. I was supposed to leave for London on March 5th for a week off. Usually when I take a week off, I do things I can't do working early in the morning. I go see shows, I go to people's places. So that was my plan. A week before I was scheduled to leave, I had lunch with a friend who's into the public health loop. It was a terrible lunch. He kind of drew me a picture of this other shoe that was probably going to drop on the COVID-19 front. And a few days later, when a few villages started shutting down in Italy, I canceled my flight and I did not leave. This is March 5th. But I barely told anyone because I was afraid people would laugh at me for having canceled the trip. I would have returned on the day of the big shutdown a week later. So when people say, oh, you know, we saw this coming, I remind myself that I pretended I was away for a week and did all kinds of other things like fill prescriptions and stuff like that, because I didn't want to tell anyone that I chickened out of flying to London. So this is a roundabout way to answer the question about how would governments know what's speculative and why would they be the judge of that? So no, I can't see what knowledge they would bring that would allow them to say, you know, masks are not necessary. Masks are very, very useful. Everyone is kind of treading on unexplored territory.
That is part of the experience, isn't it? We are all trying to figure things out, and we can get information, but we've got to sort through it ourselves in some ways and look for the right sources, because yes, we're all learning.
And so I'm old enough to have been around when HIV first came about. I remember, you know, what used to be said at first, how it evolved, how we got to the knowledge that we have today. It did not happen over the course of 3 months. And a lot of assumptions over that period were proven wrong. Others sadly turned out to be right. But that is how acquiring experience happens. And this is, we're into, sadly, an experiment, a collective one.
David Latimer has a question. It seems the media are much tougher on their leaders in the US than they are in Canada. Not as much pushback on reopening plans and testing and tracking strategy, for example. Do you agree?
No, but I nor do I suffer from envy of the political leadership in the US. I agree that there is not in this country a mainstream politician that is arguing that we should just reopen the economy and everything will be nice and dandy. So journalists have to cover, an argument, you have to have an argument. I'm not seeing any opposition party or mainstream opposition party in any province or first minister arguing or saying the kind of things that Donald Trump is saying. And if any of them were, there would be a lot of pushback for the notion that Javex is good for your health.
In line with that, then on the other, on the cooperative side, Wilf Day writes, the coalition government of New Zealand led by Jacinda Ardern has shown how to deal with COVID-19. So have minority governments, depending on cooperation between parties in BC and New Brunswick. Other stable coalition governments in Europe have done better than the one-party governments like Trump. Will this make Canadian voters more open to the coalition governments, which places with proportional representation usually elect?
Boy. It's an interesting debate and an interesting question, but I don't think that voters think like that. I think most voters do appreciate some of the give and take that we've seen in federal and provincial politics over the past few months. And I don't see very many people missing the kind of cheap partisanship that is often a feature of our politics. But whether that translates into, you know, a sudden let's have coalition government, I'll just question one premise in this in the question. I'm not sure that most Canadians find coalition governments abhorrent. If you propose one, there might be, you know, if Justin Trudeau tomorrow morning decided that he would like to have invite Jagmeet Singh to sit in his cabinet as his health minister or deputy prime minister, I don't think that many liberals would object. I suspect most New Democrats would be overjoyed. If I add up their two scores, I get to an overwhelming majority of voters.
Interesting.
I'm not suggesting that he should. I'm just saying, if that happened, I don't think it would be poorly received.
Here's a question from Faye Cohen. How badly some U.S. states have dealt with the COVID crisis, what do you think will happen with opening the border? Any of our borders with the rest of the world?
We will at some point reopen our borders as Europe is tentatively reopening borders between its member states. The mention earlier about the success of New Zealand. New Zealand does not have the U.S. As a land neighbor, and the level of exchanges between the two countries, people going back and forth, is significant. Which is why I suspect that if most premiers, starting with those in Ontario and Quebec, have their way, we would keep the border limited to essential travel for at least until the fall. And I see from polls that a majority or a plurality of Canadians would like the border to remain closed until the end of the year. So I am not necessarily convinced that we will be going to the beaches south of us within the next 2 months. But the issue always is that you have to, this is something that has to, it's a two-way street. So you've got to have the Americans on side. So probably in this country, political pressure on Justin Trudeau from the provinces will be to keep the border as shut as possible going forward.
Do you anticipate that being a bit of a fight with the U.S. to do that? Or will they not notice? I mean, I know there's a lot of trade, but I'm thinking about the U.S. public in general.
I suspect that as long as trade and the people who work on both sides are able to go back and forth. And given that we've canceled a lot of the things that draw people to this country in the summer, things like, you know, that there's not going to be a Montreal Jazz Festival, which is when I see the streets around my house filled with U.S. cars. So no Grand Prix, you know, we've canceled summer except for the weather. So I'm not too sure that there are people lining up to cross the border to come into Canada or vice versa.
Here's a question from Kate Bandura. How does COVID-19 affect Canada's role in the rule-based world order?
Oh, I don't think that Canada has a central role as in a superpower role in rule-based order. I also think that the more interesting question is where will the U.S. Fit into this world, the post-pandemic world? Because up to a point, and that is also true, I'm guessing, of the current UK government, isolationism may be finding new strength from the pandemic. The notion that if you can isolate yourself, you're going to be better. The idea that you can close your borders and that's a good public policy means that countries who depend on trade, and we are one of them, will have to try to find allies to argue the case that we can't go back to a time when countries were separated by walls. We've moved past that. And it's a lot of the way forward will depend on the outcome of the U.S. election next November.
Hmm. Got a journalism question for you from Shadi Afifi. Do you think the current epidemic writes the last chapter of paper journalism and shifts into using technology? And I'm just going to say at another level, I'm shortening the question there, but...
I'm not a news manager, and I'm glad I am not, so I'm not going to be answering the question, except to note that most of the news already moves through more technologically advanced means than a paper copy, and that has been the trend for a good number of years. So the issue is not changed in the sense that it is not, we've never had so many readers. Again, during this period, more and more and more readers. The issue is always the same. what is the financial model that replaces the advertising that used to make paper or print publications profitable? And that quest remains unresolved. It's probably made more acute by the losses incurred over the past 3, 4, 5 months. So beyond that, I'm not even going to chance a guess as to how long we can keep our print papers going in this country.
I'm going to just do one final question, Chantel. And this one's from me. What kind of political reckoning do you see coming down the road?
That's interesting. I'm hoping it's not a political reckoning or a prediction. I'm hoping that this period will have given the opposition parties who have been taken off the stage by the crisis a chance to evaluate how useful and how constructive they could be going forward, because we will have to have some very difficult fascinating public policy debates once the crisis is past. And I think watching, you know, the premier whose image is most changed in this has been Premier Ford. If you by the numbers, but also by the sea change in the perception, what that tells me is that there's always a best to be had from your politicians. And we've had a lot of the best from the premiers. I'm hoping that the opposition brings their best game and not in the partisan sense to what comes after.
Well, that's a lot to think about and watch for. Thank you for your insights today.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you. Thank you. That's Chantel Hébert. We're going to end it there. Thank you, everyone, for listening and sending in your questions. We hope you join us for a few more upcoming webcasts. Next Thursday, May 28th, Heather Scofield, economics columnist and Ottawa bureau chief with the Toronto Star, will offer her her perspective on the implications of COVID-19 for the Canadian economy and covering the biggest economic challenge of our time. On June 4th, Susan B. Glasser, the Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker, will join us to share her thoughts on U.S. politics, leadership, and the pandemic. You can get a sneak peek at what she's thinking by reading what she's been putting in The New Yorker lately. On June 11th, the CJF is going virtual for its annual CJF Awards ceremony to celebrate journalistic excellence. And you can watch that at 1 o'clock Eastern or the rebroadcast the same evening, 7 p.m. on June 11th. And you can tune in then with a glass in hand. Of course, you could always tune in at one with a glass in hand too. Anyway, view the details and register for these webcasts on our CJF website. And we hope you join us. See you next time. Bye-bye.